So you may remember then that our present Sunday morning series is entitled Consider Your Calling. And over a few Sunday mornings then, we're exploring this New Testament teaching that we as Christians have been called by God. And in our first session then, we looked at the reality of our calling. And we established that at the beginning of our Christian lives, God didn't merely invite us to become Christians in the way that every time the gospel is preached, many, many people are invited to become Christians, many who ultimately will never become Christians, many who will ultimately be lost. No, God didn't just invite us to become Christians in the same way that many people are invited, but rather God did something distinct in our case. God issued this summons to us that was so loaded with divine power and authority that it actually made us Christians. It actually converted us. It didn't merely prompt us. It didn't merely stimulate us to believe in Jesus Christ. In the same way that when in an hour's time I call Fraser to come and get into the car out there, hopefully it will prompt him, it will stimulate him to come and get into the car. No, this call that we receive from God, it actually made us believers in Christ. It produced infallibly and irresistibly that response of believing in Jesus in a way that my call can never actually forcibly make Fraser get into the car. So that's what we established in the first session then, the reality of our calling. But then in our second session, we looked at the context of our calling. And there we established then that God called us in a certain context, culturally, domestically, professionally, socially. Our lives had a certain shape to them at that point when God called us. And we saw then that for the most part, God's conversion calling requires no change in that shape to our lives. No change at that level, no change in the circumstantial setting. The circumstantial setting of our pre-calling, non-Christian lives remains the circumstantial setting of our post-calling, Christian lives. And that's then what we discovered in that second session, the context. But then in our third session, we looked at the implications of our calling. And we asked the important question then, if a new set of circumstances, culturally and domestically and professionally and socially, if that is not an implication of our being called by God, then what are the implications? What does it mean that we have been called by God? And you may remember we identified three initial implications then of our calling. First of all, a relationship. Our text there was 1 Corinthians 1:9, that God has called us into the fellowship of his Son, Jesus Christ. We've been called into an intimate relationship with Jesus. Implication number two, an experience, namely suffering. Our text there was 1 Peter 2:21, that in the footsteps of Christ we have been called to endure suffering. And then implication number three, an orientation towards others. And we identified various texts that brought out that truth. Well, this morning then, we're going to continue on this theme of the implications of our calling. And I have three more then. Three more implications of our calling. Our methodology is going to be the same. Of course, as I said last time, I'm not implying that at the end of the day there are only six implications of our calling. Every single feature of the Christian life, every responsibility, every character trait of the Christian is an implication of our calling. But there'd be too many of those to count, let alone to study in a sermon series. So we're confining ourselves instead to those New Testament texts which actually use the language of calling as they set forth the implications of our calling. So without further ado then, let's consider then implication number four. And that is then a state. We've had a relationship, an experience, an orientation. Fourthly, a state. And earlier on then in our service, we read, didn't we, that chapter from the Apostle Paul, Galatians chapter 5. And in the middle of that chapter, Paul comes out with a momentous statement. Verse 13 of Galatians 5, he says, "You were called to freedom, brothers." So as Christians then, we have been called to a state of freedom. And of course, we need to immediately ask the question, well, what does that mean? Well, it's clear that there was a particular issue on Paul's mind as he wrote this chapter. And that issue is indicated by a word that he uses in verse 4. There he uses the word justified. Justified. Now, we still use that word, don't we, that verb justify. But we tend to use it in a fairly loose sense. To us, it basically means defend. So we might say, well, can I justify spending this amount of money on this item of clothing or on this gadget or whatever? Can I defend it? That's what we basically mean. It's a fairly loose use of the word. But the word Paul uses here has a more specific and technical meaning than that. It's a word taken from the law court, actually. It's a legal word. And justifying then was something in Paul's day that a judge did. And I suppose the closest word that we do have in our parlance today is perhaps the word acquit. We would talk about a judge acquitting someone. We wouldn't really use acquit in any other context, but we would use in that legal context, a judge acquits someone. In other words, a judge clears someone. A judge declares a person to be in the right. A person who perhaps has many charges against them. Evidence has been brought against them, but the judge has cleared that person. The judge has declared that person the right. That person has been acquitted. And that's really what this word justified means that Paul uses in verse 4. It's a word that refers to a judge declaring a person to be in the right. And Paul then, he is addressing these Galatians and he uses the phrase, "you who will be justified." So he's talking about them being justified. And so it raises the question then, well, what's going on here? Are these Galatian Christians, are they facing some kind of legal problems? Is it that the Galatian Secular Society or the Galatian Equality Commission are trying to take them to court? What's the context here? Why is he talking about judges and acquittals at all? Well, the answer is, of course, that Paul here isn't talking about any human court. And any human judge. What he has in mind is the ultimate court, God's court. It's a basic biblical truth, isn't it? That God, as it were, wears many hats. He fulfills many different roles. He is a creator. He is a sustainer. But the Bible also makes clear he's a judge. We have that great description of him from the lips of Abraham in Genesis 18:25. He's the judge of all the earth. And that means, if God is the judge of all the earth, that means that there is a certain question which you may never even have thought of before. It may never have struck you before. But there's a certain question which is actually the most important question of all that hangs over your life today. And that question is this: what is your position in that court, that ultimate court? What is your standing before that ultimate judge? Does he acquit you this morning? Does he justify you? Or does he condemn you? Or to use slightly different language that we also encounter in the New Testament, does he declare you righteous this morning? Or does he declare you guilty? As I say, that question may never have been on your radar throughout all the years, decades perhaps, that you've lived on this earth. But that actually is the most important question that hangs over your life this morning. Now, assuming we take this concept seriously, then, that we are all accountable to an ultimate judge, a cosmic judge. And actually, I think we all take that seriously. We may put up a veneer of atheism and say, oh, there's no judge and there's no heavenly courts. But I think all of us deep down take that concept seriously. We all know we're accountable ultimately. And assuming that then, we can approach this matter in different ways. Let's just quickly consider three. First of all, we can seek God's approval on the basis of our moral goodness. So knowing then that there is a judge to whom we are accountable, a judge who either acquits or condemns, declares righteous or guilty, we can seek his approval on the basis of our moral goodness. So our being charitable, our being helpful, our being neighbourly, our being good and decent citizens, perhaps our being a good spouse, or our being good children to parents who are getting older, whatever it might be. And of course, millions of people, even though they might not phrase it in these terms, that we're seeking God's approval on the basis of our moral goodness, millions of people are doing that. Perhaps you're doing that this morning. Perhaps you are seeking to please God and secure his approval by being good. Well, there's much that we could say in response to that. But the thing that's most pertinent to our theme this morning is this. There is no freedom down that route. It is an enslaving route to try to walk down. Enslaving in a couple of ways. For one thing, you will constantly be plagued by the question, am I doing enough? Am I doing enough good deeds? Am I being charitable enough, helpful enough, neighborly enough, a good enough spouse, a good enough child to my aging parents? Good enough to satisfy the standards of that cosmic judge? Good enough to offset the many times in my life when I've actually been very unhelpful and very unneighborly and very uncharitable? Constantly plagued. Am I doing enough? And then the other way that it's enslaving is that the good deeds that you do perform actually will be very joyless in themselves. We use often in the wrong way that word disinterested. People use the word disinterested when they mean uninterested. So if I were to say to Hannah on the journey home this morning, well, the congregation looked pretty disinterested this morning as I was preaching, I might be right that you look very uninterested, but I'd be using the wrong word. Because disinterested actually isn't a negative word, it's a very positive word. To do something in a disinterested way means to do it even though it's of no interest to you. It's not gaining you. You don't stand to gain by doing that thing. But you're doing it anyway. That's what disinterested means. And so it's a positive thing to do something in a disinterested way. You're doing it entirely for the benefit of someone else, not for your own interests. But you see, if you're seeking God's approval on the basis of your moral goodness, then actually all your neighborliness and all your kindness to others and your helpfulness, none of it will be disinterested. You stand to gain. You're doing it for yourself at the end of the day. You're doing it to try to seek God's approval. And so they will be cheerless, joyless acts that really you're just doing to get brownie points, as we say, for yourself before God. So we can seek God's approval on the basis of our moral goodness. Secondly, we can seek God's approval on the basis of our religious observance. And this, I think, is what Paul particularly has in mind there in verse 4, because notice his phrase is, you who will be justified by the law. what's the law here? Well, in the previous two verses, he's mentioned circumcision, hasn't he? Circumcision, of course, was a central requirement of the law of Moses. And so that's what he has in mind here, the law of Moses, and particularly its religious practices like circumcision. So he's writing here to the Galatian Christians, of course. Now, these are people then who have heard the Christian message about Jesus dying on the cross. Paul says in chapter 3, verse 1, it was placarded before you, that message, when you became Christians. And they've believed that. They've believed in the Christian message of Jesus dying on the cross. And they still believe that message. But it seems that they've come to believe that, yes, the dying of Jesus on the cross, that's a necessary component of our standing in our standing before God. That's a necessary component in securing God's approval. But keeping the law of Moses is also a necessary component. That's another necessary thing. Yes, we believe in Jesus dying on the cross, but we also must keep the law of Moses. We must be circumcised. We must observe these practices. And again, many people today are basing their hopes of God's approval on religious observance, aren't they? And again, perhaps you are this morning. Even the fact that you're here, your church attendance, perhaps that's what you're basing your hopes of God's approval on. Your baptism, your participation in the Lord's Supper every month or whatever. What you put in the bowl there, your giving to the church. And again, there's much we could say in response to that, but again, most pertinent to our theme this morning, there's no freedom down that route either. Paul says, doesn't he, it's a yoke of slavery, verse 1. It's enslaving to base your hopes of God's approval on your religious observance. It's a powerful phrase, that a yoke of slavery. It's an unnecessary kind of coupling together of two things. I mean, a yoke is itself an enslaving thing, but it's a yoke of slavery. Paul is really emphasizing this. He's saying, look, think of basing such a huge issue as your standing before God on the fact that a bit of skin has been removed from your body in a surgical procedure called circumcision. Or in our case, imagine basing your standing before God on the fact that you've had a bit of water applied to you and a few words said at that time. Or the fact that you've sat for many hours of your life on a pew in a church building through services. Imagine basing this huge issue on such a flimsy foundation. You wouldn't have to be a worrier. You wouldn't have to have a nervous disposition to often wake up in the night in a cold sweat, basing your standing before God on something so flimsy. So again, there's no freedom that way. But then thirdly, we can seek God's approval on the basis of Jesus dying on the cross. That's a third option. We can seek God's approval on the basis of Jesus dying on the cross. And here I mean then, Jesus dying on the cross full stop. Not Jesus dying on the cross as a necessary component, but as the only component. And that then is the real Christian gospel. And this whole unnecessary component business was a distortion of the gospel. Paul says in chapter 1, verse 6, it's a different gospel that you Galatians are flirting with. And Paul recognizes that this then, basing our hopes of God's approval on Jesus dying on the cross alone, it's counterintuitive. It goes against the grain. He says even in verse 11 of our chapter here that it's offensive, the offense of the cross, he says, because it's a damning indictment of us that we can't contribute anything. Jesus had to do it all for us on the cross. But the great thing is that this route leads to freedom. Whereas moral goodness, whereas religious observance can give you no freedom, seeking God's approval on the basis of Jesus dying on the cross. That, Paul says, leads to freedom. Because you go to bed each night saying, well, my standing before God, it's utterly unrelated to anything I've done today or haven't done today, or anything I've done or haven't done throughout my whole life, or will do or won't do throughout the rest of my life. It's based entirely on what someone else did. And there's freedom there. There's freedom. There's liberation. And so Paul is saying in verse 13 that you've been called to that. You've been called to the freedom of basing your standing before God on what somebody else has done. And that is freedom, isn't it? In those moments when you're facing the reality of your own guilt, you've messed up big time, and your conscience is plaguing you and shouting at you, isn't it freedom in those moments to be able to say, this doesn't affect my standing before God? Those times when other people are wrongly accusing us of doing something. And that's hurtful and it's hard, it's painful. Isn't it liberating to be able to say to ourselves, well, God isn't accusing me this morning. I'm justified before him. Those moments when we're facing death, when we're staring death in the face. Isn't it liberating that we don't have to rake through our lives as we lie on our deathbeds, counting up the good deeds to make sure the tally's big enough? I'm justified because of what Jesus did. There's something so liberating, so freeing about basing our standing before God on Jesus dying on the cross, full stop. Are you enjoying that freedom this morning as a Christian? Are you feeling weighed down? Come back to this seminal gospel truth. You have been called to freedom. So estates. But then implication number five, a lifestyle. A lifestyle. Galatians 5 is quite surprising, really. Because after being so emphatic that we have been called to freedom, that we are free, Paul then moves on, doesn't he, in the last part of chapter 5, to emphasize good works. So having been so emphatic that we are free people, we are free from slavishly engaging in good works to secure our standing before God, he then goes on to talk about the huge importance of good works, concluding with those famous words, that's chapter 6, verse 9. Let us not grow weary of doing good. What's going on here? Is he contradicting himself? Well, of course he's not. The point is that he's not talking at the end of chapter 5 here about slavishly engaging in good works to secure our standing before God. No, he's saying, our standing before God, having been fully and finally secured by what Jesus did on the cross, now we can engage in good works, not slavishly, joyfully, freely, happily, in grateful love toward the God who has liberated us. In other words, the good works that we're talking about now at the end of chapter 5 are completely different, or at least they're in a completely different setting. They belong to a completely different atmosphere to the good works I was talking about earlier, where we're trying to secure God's approval. This is utterly different. But these good works are real nonetheless. And that's what I mean then when I say that we have been called to a lifestyle of good works, as it's perhaps most succinctly in Romans 1 verse 7, called, Paul says, to be saints. That's how he describes the Romans, called to be saints. And of course, saints, as you know, in the New Testament means set apart ones, those who are distinctive in their lifestyle. And so we've been called then to a lifestyle of good works. And let's just notice quickly two things about it. First of all, it's standard. It's standard. And The text to which I would draw your attention here is 1 Peter 1, verse 15, where Peter writes this. He says in verse 14, as obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. And then verse 15, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Now we're familiar with those words, but they are massive, aren't they? Peter is saying that the standard of this lifestyle to which we've been called is God's own lifestyle. Be holy with the kind of holiness of the one who called you to holiness. That's what Peter is saying. It kind of, I think, sheds light on other texts we encounter in Peter's letter. You're struck, aren't you, when you read Peter's first letter about how highly he regards the transforming potential of Christian living. In other words, he expects the transformed lives of Christians to have a transforming effect on other people's lives. So in chapter 2, verse 12, he says, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honourable, or the pagans honourable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Peter's there saying, live such good lives that those who initially accuse you of evil will actually then be converted and will praise God on the day that Jesus Christ returns. He expects Christian living to have a powerful impact on those around them. Well, is it any wonder if Christian living means resembling, replicating the very holiness of God himself? Again, chapter 3, verse 1, he talks to Christian wives who have unbelieving husbands. And he says, your husbands be won without a word by the conduct of you wives. Again, is it any wonder if the conduct of these Christian wives is godlike conduct? It's godlike purity, godlike holiness. Kind of cast light on chapter 5, verse 3, where Peter talks about elders being examples to the flock. Examples of what? Examples of kind of just minimal rule-keeping, because that's what the Christian life involves. No, examples of godlike holiness. That's why it's an awesome responsibility to be an elder. Why we should pray for the elders of this church, because they are called to be examples of godlike behavior, godlike holiness for the rest of the flock. So that's its standard. But then, secondly, notice the scope of this lifestyle. The scope of it, and of course it ranges over a whole spectrum of behaviours. And we talked last time about that orientation toward others and living at peace with one another. And that's part then of this lifestyle to which we've been called. But one other aspect of it comes out in another New Testament text, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 7. Where Paul writes, God has not called us for impurity, but in holiness. God has called us not for impurity, but for holiness. And it's clear from the paragraph there, 1 Thessalonians 4, that he's talking about sexual purity. He's mentioned in verse 4 about controlling one's own body in holiness and honor, not in the passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God. And so this lifestyle then to which we've been called, this godlike lifestyle, it ranges from treating other people properly within church. That's what we emphasized last time. But it ranges from that to sexual purity. That's what Paul's emphasizing in 1 Thessalonians 4. And we often encounter that emphasis. We've encountered it recently in the book of Proverbs, haven't we? But how we need it stressed, don't we? In our society, in all its sexual perversion and pollution. Think of a film that we're all aware of, released 2 weeks ago. And it's so easy, isn't it, for us to become acclimatized, and it's a mainstream film, and our friends at work who are normally fairly decent people are talking about it and going to see it. And we can easily just start to think, well, maybe it's okay to go along with this sort of stuff. And then we've had this emphasis in Galatians on freedom. We're free people. Perhaps we've been a bit puritanical in the past, we can start to think. Perhaps the behavior that Mike was talking about on Wednesday nights, of being self-controlled about what we watch, turning the television off when we need to turn it off because of what's come up. Perhaps it's all a bit over the top. It's a bit puritanical. We're free, aren't we? Having so many rules for ourselves, isn't it compromising, undermining our freedom? But you see, the issue isn't how many rules we have for ourselves. The issue is the motive behind those rules. And yes, it's quite possible for a Christian to have a whole load of rules for himself, and it's all about securing brownie points before God, and it's a legalistic thing, and there's no freedom there. But it's equally possible for a Christian to have a whole load of rules for himself, and that Christian is free and happy and knows that his standing before God is based on what Jesus has done, but he's so keen to please God, and he's so aware he's been called to a lifestyle of holiness, that that's why he's diligent about what his eyes see and what he does and how he uses his time and so on. Are you energetically pursuing this lifestyle to which we've been called? This lifestyle that is godlike, this lifestyle that ranges from treating others properly in church to sexual purity. It's a challenge, the lifestyle. So a state, a lifestyle, but then the sixth implication, a mood. A mood. Because I guess you might say, well, sounds all very simple. We've been called to this lifestyle. And sitting here on a Sunday morning, it sounds wonderfully simple. But of course we know, don't we, that actually implementing this lifestyle to which we've been called is hard. We're very aware there's Satan out there who wants to inhibit and stop and impede that lifestyle being cultivated within us. We're very aware of the flesh within. And Paul talks about that, doesn't he, there in Galatians 5, that passage we read earlier on. We're very aware of all these obstacles to us cultivating that lifestyle. It's hard, and perhaps at times we can feel crushed and we can feel pessimistic and despairing. That can be our mood as we think about our Christian lives. Oh, I'm never going to be able to master this lifestyle to which we've been called. But we don't need to yield to despair and pessimism. For one thing, Paul emphasizes there in Galatians 5, doesn't he, that we've been given the Holy Spirit. That there's not just the flesh at work within us, there's the Spirit at work within us. He talks about in Galatians 5:18 about us being led by the Spirit. That's nothing to do with guidance, being led to go to a particular university, or being led to take up a certain job, or led to marry a certain person. It's not guidance. It's to do with sanctification, being led in a military way. The Spirit leads us in that daily battle. He's our commander in chief. He leads us in that daily battle against the flesh. That's how he leads us. And so for that reason, we don't need to succumb to this mood of despair. But then there's another reason we don't. And this is my final text then for today. And it's again in 1 Thessalonians. And it's right at the end of the book. 1 Thessalonians, verses 23 and 24. In verse 23, Paul expresses his desire that the Thessalonian believers should be completely sanctified. Sanctified, that means made holy. Through and through, he says. Spirit, soul, body, sanctified through and through. That's what he wishes. That's what he desires there in verse 23. And then in verse 24, he begins this way. He who calls you is. How do you expect him to finish that sentence? Well, if you're familiar with 1 Peter 1:15 that we referred to earlier, perhaps you expect him to complete it something like this. He who calls you is holy, and he will surely demand this sanctification in you. And that would be true, but that's not how he finishes his sentence. He says, not he who calls you is holy. He picks on another attribute of God. He who calls you is faithful. And not he will demand it, but he will do it. And you see what he's saying there? He's saying that this God who has called you, that converting call that we're thinking about in this series, that God is committed to making you holy. He's called you to a lifestyle, and he's committed to you being marked by that lifestyle. And he's faithful, and he follows through all his commitments, and he will make sure that you do cultivate that lifestyle. Now, that's not then kind of releasing us from any responsibility. We need to pursue holiness, of course we do. But this is the bottom line, Paul is saying. You don't need to despair. You don't need to have that mood. You can have this mood of hopeful confidence, an expectation. I will grow day by day by day by day in holiness and likeness to Jesus. As surely as my outward man fades away, my inner man will be renewed day by day, in the language of another text. Because God is committed to this. He who called me is faithful and will ensure it happens. And so let's go into this week and into the rest of our lives, yes, determined that we are going to practice holiness, but yes, also confident that behind all that is a God who is committed to making us holy. What a comfort that is. We thank God for it. Amen.